Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour is going to be one large, large treat for those of you who are already fans of Bob and Ray. And there may be a few of you who have never heard of them before, but by the end of this hour, you will have become a fan and your life will be better. You're going to hear one of their comedy bits, like Slow Talkers of America, which remains just as funny today as it was over 40 years ago. Or you will hear later in the hour David Pollack, author of the just-released Bob and Ray, Keener Than Most Persons, and you'll be tempted to read the book. Or you will listen to Bob Elliott, who is still alive. He just turned 90, and I had the great privilege to listen to his memories about Bob and Ray in an interview that we did last week. Bob, it is amazing to me that you worked together, Bob and Ray, for 40 years. That's a long period of time. How can you do that for so long?
Well, I'll tell you, I think the secret really is that we looked at our shows as a job, and we had an office, and we came to the office in the morning and talked over what we might do that day, and whatever business it was, and then we'd walk to the studio across town in New York and do the show and enjoyed it and enjoyed each other's work and company. And then at the end of the day, say 5 o'clock, Ray took a train for Long Island where he lived, and I walked home to my house in the city where we lived.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, with no mean intention, I think the fact that we weren't together any more than a working day, I think that's why it worked so well.
Right. I'm wondering if you were funny as a child.
I think if you ask my late parents, they would probably say I was. I don't remember being particularly funny, but I guess I said good things that, like you remember, and I didn't really ever plan to go into comedy, but it, when I met Ray and we began to work together, it just it fell into place, and like many teams, I think it started by accident, and we never planned to be a team. It just turned out that way.
I want you to talk a little bit about this show that you did 25 minutes before each of the Red Sox baseball games. I've read that's where you started. You realized you had this chemistry. What did you do in that 25-minute period of time, Bob?
Well, we the WHDH, where we worked in Boston, acquired the baseball games right toward the end of the war. And they had new management, and it was the management, Bill McGrath mainly, was developing new shows. And baseball then was mostly in the daytime. And we had both the Red Sox and the Braves there to begin with. And he wanted a show that would create a little following before the games each afternoon. And we'd been kibitzing back and forth on the morning time, where I had a record show and Ray did the news. And he said, why don't you try doing this off-the-cuff stuff just before the ball games? And we did, and that became Matinee with Bob and Ray. And he gave us a organ piano team of live music, and we all four had a good time at it. And in the fall, he just kept it on and called it Matinee with Bob and Ray.
And all of the marvelous characters that you did were spontaneous, or did the two of you sit over a legal pad and figure out all of these characters?
No, we just have to look around us. And
they're all around.
In any radio station in those days, the late 40s and the 50s, there were different types of people who came in and out. There was a woman's show every morning, and that was where we adapted that particular character into Mary Magoon. Obviously, the name was close to Mary Margaret McBride. It was Mary Margaret Magoon, actually. And there was a farm director, and if you think of some of the things we did, you'll recognize that they were patterned after people around us. Wally Ballou was really the morning janitor, and we developed him into the character he was.
Mm-hmm. Your career, I guess I didn't really realize, Bob, how expansive it was, and the chapters about your being all over the place. You're doing things in Hawaii. You're on the Johnny Carson show. You're doing television appearances everywhere. You guys really took off, didn't you?
Well, television was just being born when we came to New York in 1951. And they put us on the network. First time anybody had been allowed to go on the air without a pre-okayed script. And they took a chance. They knew what we'd been doing in Boston. And so we did radio all hours of the day. And out of that came the offers to do the talk shows, although we also did our own 15-minute TV show in the early 50s, but radio always appealed to us more. But out of the start we got, we created a name fairly quickly, and we got requests for appearances, including Carson and Parr and all the others.
You must be, on some level, you're a very humble man, but you must be proud of the fact that you really were a comedian's comedian.
Well, I am terribly proud of that. I reached the nonagenarian age last March, and I can't get used to being called the grand old man of comedy, but I'm going after George Burns' record, not in laughs, but in longevity. So we'll see.
Good for you. I'm
There's
sure
quite
you
a few behind me. Bob Newhart's not back of me very far, and Dick Cavett will come along.
Mm-hmm. You were on the Bob Newhart show for at least an episode, weren't you?
Played his father. I think it was on one of the episodes of the one where he had the inn in Vermont. I think it was just called Newhart.
Mm-hmm. Tell
and
us.
We had,
I'm sorry.
And our first movie was he was in that, and we got to know him quite well, and that was Cold Turkey way back. And so we over the years we came across Bob on different series and in different stages. The Sullivan Show, he was on with him one night, and he became a good friend and was great to play his father.
I was interested in the part of the book that talked about your venturing into an area that probably was a little nerve-wracking for both of you, and that's when you did a Broadway show.
We did.
And you and all the critics were in the audience the first night that could have made or broken the show. Why did it make you nervous to do that?
Well, the critics didn't make us nervous because we knew they'd be there, and We worried about doing the same thing night after night if it were successful, because we were radio, and to get the show together, we had to go through a lot of tapes of shows that we had done and pick out the skits we liked, the bits and the characters, and then put it on paper and then learn it. I've said this so many times, but we both, Ray and I both, said, how can we do this? It was stuff that we ad-libbed, that was very natural to us, but here again, we're going to be in front of 700 or 800 people every night and do it. But once we got by the opening jitters and decided to do it. We rehearsed and had previews, and we opened, and it was a surprising success. We mm-hmm. ran almost 6 months, and that's quite good for a two-man show.
Did you have a good time?
Oh, yeah, we did, and we traveled with it. We went up to Toronto for 2 weeks, and we went to Florida for 6 weeks, and we played the theater in Washington where Lincoln was shot. What am I talking about?
Yes, the Ford
Theater.
Theater. Mm-hmm.
And that was a great experience, but kind of eerie looking up at the box where it's supposed to have happened.
I imagine.
And we had some funny things happen. During the intermission in Washington, they brought back a man who had an operation on his upper lip, and he had split the stitches laughing in the first half of the show.
Oh.
And they got a doctor to fix him up, and he guaranteed he was going to stay for the second show regardless. But
that's
we didn't see him afterwards. I don't know whether he did.
Is this story true? I think that there was some question about, and this is one of my favorite bits you guys ever did. I love Slow Talkers of America. Every time I hear it, it's as though it's the first time I've heard it, and I just laugh hysterically. But wasn't there some question about whether or not that should be in the Broadway show?
Probably. It was... again, one of those things we had ad-libbed originally, and so many people that we had met and talked to kind of talked that way. I know people in my family did, and we just started fooling around with that one day. We said, "Well, let's do that on the show today." We did it, and then we did it on one of the TV shows where we had Ray practically go out of his mind with my slow talking, and that proved to us that we could play that in front of people and they would laugh, and they did.
I haven't had a chance or an opportunity to talk to our next guest here, so I wonder if you would be kind enough to tell us your name and where you come from.
Harlow. P. Whitcomb from Glens Falls,
New York, right? Glens Falls, New York.
New York. I'm president and recording
secretary. Recording secretary. Right?
Secretary of the S T O A.
What does that stand for?
The Slow Talkers of
America.
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 How could you not laugh at that one? It really is a masterpiece.
Well, it's a simple thing, but I have people come up to me, however, and they start doing that to me, and I'm so thick I don't understand it until they've done it for about 5 minutes, and then I realize you're giving it to me. But that was a favorite, as well as the Komodo Dragon expert. I kind of figure I own the rights to the Komodo Dragon. I'd never heard of him before the show, and came upon the name one day and looked it up. And we had often had guests on our show before the ball games, real guests, who apparently came to the show with only 6 pieces of information about the subject they were going to talk about.
Yes.
And that was what the Komodo Dragon expert was based on, just 6 things about the Komodo Dragon repeatedly expressed in different ways. And that just built another breakup for Ray, where he had to just call a bit off at the end, but that always got a great hand.
Yeah, it's a marvelous piece as well. I didn't know that you did this NBC special with members of the original Saturday Night Live cast.
Yeah, we did. I can't remember the year of that, but they were having a problem some backstage with the production of the show, and Al Franken and Tom Davis were big fans, and they came up to the office and they said, we're going to do a show with Jane, Lorraine, and Gilda, and we want you to be with them. And we do what? I mean, is this going to be a regular Saturday Night Light show? And he said, no, it's a special. They're changing production people, and I don't know what all the thing was, or I don't remember it now, but we ended up doing it, and it was a great deal of fun, and the high spot of that was a bit that we absolutely turned down for days before we finally broke down and agreed to do it, and that was Rod Stewart, do you think I'm sexy? And we sat in business suits, and the girls did the backup singing behind us, and they say I had people tell me that was the greatest thing they'd seen to date.
We're trying to find that online somewhere. I hope we can, because I've never seen that, Bob, and I'm sure it's pretty funny.
Find it. That was the hit of the thing, and then they settled all their problems, and the show continued. And my son Chris, of course, was on it for a couple of years.
Right.
And so was his daughter Abby, who was there 3 years, I think. This is the first year. She hasn't been there for a while. But they all, it makes three generations of people at one point that were connected with SNL.
Wonderful. And yet you mentioned radio, and you said radio was really your medium. I agree with you. I love radio. But why? Why was it your medium?
I think that before you had a TV in every room, you had to visualize for yourself anything you heard on the radio. And that's why there were so many crime dramas and adventure series and travel and anything you could think of, you could sit and listen to. You had nothing to look at except a loudspeaker, but you did think a lot, and there was no talking, at least in my house, when our favorite shows were on. And you built up a whole picture of what all these people looked like. It was quite a disappointment sometimes when we went to see real broadcasts in New York when I was a kid, and to see how the people looked that we'd been imagining for years. But we, Ray and I, being both very good looking, didn't ever worry about that.
And people must have come up to you after you were on Saturday Night Live and said, "Hey, Bob, yes, you are sexy."
Yeah, give us a chorus of that.
Exactly. Well, I thank you so much, Bob, for being with us for part of this show. You are really a treasure, and it is so good to hear your voice again,
well,
sir.
Well, thank you very much.
Bob Elliott, we had a chance to speak last week. He turned 90 years old in March. We are going to, he mentioned Komodo Dragon. If you have not heard that comedy piece, stay tuned. You will hear that, and you'll hear much more about Bob and Ray, because the author of the just-released book, Bob and Ray Keener, than most persons. Will be joining us in just a moment, David Pollack, and we'll be welcoming your phone calls as well. I know there are Bob and Ray fans in the audience. We have played them as we've done comedy shows, and they also were on NPR for quite some period of time, so feel free to join the conversation, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org, and if you'd like to... Actually, this would make a fun thing for you to do. Go to our Facebook page, and those of you who are fans, write down your favorite Bob and Ray pieces, because eventually we'll do just another comedy show, and we always feature Bob and Ray. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. David Pollack joins us now. Dave is the author of the just-released Bob and Ray, Keener Than Most Persons. And David has a very illustrious career. He's written for The Steve Allen Show, The Don Rickles Show, The Carol Burnett Show, All in the Family, MASH, Cheers, and Frasier. He wrote nightclub material for Jack Benny, and he has won an Emmy, a Peabody, a Writers Guild, and several other awards. And he provides in this book the first biography of Bob and Ray. David, thank you so much for being with us. Thanks for writing the book. Hi.
Hi, Kathleen. It's a pleasure to be on with you.
Yeah, a great pleasure to have you here. I'm so glad you wrote this book about these two, and long may they live. I hope that people will listen to their comedy and think that some will for years and years to come. But, you know, when you talk to Bob, there's something just so endearing about him and so completely unaffected and genuine yet really funny. He's a unique person, and I would imagine Ray was as well, in terms of just not having much of a sense of being a big deal.
Yeah, well, you know, I think you put your finger on one of the reasons that made them so successful. Neither of them ever wanted to be comedians. They just happened to be born at a time when radio was coming of age, and it was sort of the new entertainment, mm-hmm. and like a lot of young kids growing up at that time, they sort of became fascinated with it, and with them, it just turned into something they wanted to get into, but only as announcers. They never gave any thought to doing comedy, so that when they Bob, who, as he alluded to, and when in chatting with you, was doing that morning DJ show, and Ray was doing the news, they just started kibitzing afterwards, and it just developed into comedy bits. But throughout their careers, and to your very point, they never had heightened on-air personas. You know, they sort of rode herd over a collection of characters that were sort of wacky, but... when you think about Bob and Ray as themselves, there was no real definable character. They were just these two guys with their feet on the ground. They were sort of celebrity surrogates in a way, you know, in show business, but not really of it.
I like your description. They had their feet on the ground, as everybody should. They had, as you write in your book, an immeasurable impact on generations of fans and also on peers. What was the impact?
Well, I think what people liked about them, including peers, was that they were so different. You know, up through, you know, as before they came along radio was the king. Comedy shows were always about the stars, and they had big studio audiences and orchestras and a large cast, and the stars, but the Bob Hopes, Jack Bennies, Burns and Allen, they were joke tellers. They were good jokes, and the shows were hilarious, but it was just a different style. And then as those performers moved to television. And that's just when Bob and Ray arrived at network television in 1951, when the transition was to TV. They were a whole different style, just these two voices that, as I say in the book, could suddenly become three, four, and five voices. It was sort of like a hall of mirrors for the years. They were just doing these characters that existed in their own little universe of hilariously absurd and ludicrous premises.
Mm-hmm. The you write it early on in the book that in many ways they had some very profound similarities, but it was in their differences that they found their comedy. Can you talk more about that?
Yeah. You know, in comedy, you have to have conflict. You know, that holds true for TV shows, movies, radio, and so the characters they played. You know, if you have people just agreeing with each other all the time, it's sort of hard to strike comedy. Ray's characters tended to be a little over the top, a little hyperbolic. You know, you think of people like Steve Bosco, the sportscaster character that he did, and Captain Wolf Larson, the captain of a pirate ship. In any number of Linda Lovely episodes or very backstage episodes, Bob's characters tended to be sort of highly defined theatrical types. One that always comes to mind for me is Commander Neville Putney in the feature they did, Anxiety, which was a takeoff of Suspense. But the fact of the matter is they could both play, I mean, neither of them was always a straight man, neither of them was always the funny man, you know, in various bits they just took whatever the role was. Both could play straight, both could be the funny one.
Mm-hmm. It's hard to imagine, although I'm sure this still takes place, but every time I think about the two of them being given this 20-minute spot before, of all things, sacred baseball games and radio stations. I don't know if this was the case then, but count on the radio audience for baseball to really, you know, make it a highlight of their broadcast day. But here are these guys who are given 20 minutes before a baseball game, of all things, to essentially ad lib. That's kind of unheard of.
Yeah, well, it is. And you know, as a kid listening to them, you know, I was fascinated by that. I went and watched them a few times to see how are these guys doing it? But, you know, they knew the characters so well, and they could think like them. They sort of disappeared into the characters. In the middle of those ad-lib bits, there was no Elliot and Goulding. You know, they became the characters. But when they started doing those ad-lib bits before the baseball games, as I go into in the book, a lot of it was sloppy. You know, they stepped on each other's toes, and a lot of times they would just jump out of the bed in the middle. I mean, they were ragged. But because they were spontaneous, the audience was sort of with them. And they were all parodies of radio shows that had been popular in that era. But you didn't have to be that familiar with the show to enjoy it, because they never pretended to be faithful. They were just these sort of little flights of fancy. But as I say, some of it was sloppy, and as Ray is quoted as saying in the book, it gave them a chance, an opportunity to be bad.
Hmm. You have had an illustrious career. You've done writing for The Steve Allen Show, Don Rickles, Carol Burnett, All in the Family, MASH, Cheers, Frasier, wonderful comedians and wonderful programs. Did you learn anything from their techniques? And can you also expand on how incredibly difficult it must be to get it right?
I don't know. Each show you learn things, but I think it all comes down to just sort of mimicking each one's comedy rhythms. You know, Steve Allen's on-air persona is different from Carol Burnett's or from Don Rickles, But after a few days and after years of watching them, you sort of hear their rhythms in your ear. Mm. And what it really comes down to is just mocking that or imitating it. Sort of like thinking like the characters they play on the air.
Mm-hmm. Set this up for us, and then we're going to listen to this piece from Bob and Ray, and then we'll go to phone calls. He mentioned during our interview, and this is one of their probably slow talkers, and this one of their most long-lasting bits of comedy. Do you want to set up the Komodo Dragon for us?
Sure. The Komodo Dragon expert was... Well, I don't know how to set it up without giving it away. It's probably self-contained. You probably, after we hear it, I can talk a little bit about the history of it. But I think, if I remember the opening of it, it sort of speaks for itself.
All right. Bob and the Komodo Dragon, we'll talk about this and continue our conversation with the author of the just released. And if you're a Bob and Ray fan, you got to get the book, Bob and Ray Keener Than Most Persons. We'll also welcome your phone calls. Bob and Ray right now, and one of their, I got to get the piece up here, more famous pieces of comedy. And it is, give me a second here. Yeah. Oh, there we go. I got to get the mouse on. There we go. All right. One of their more famous pieces of comedy, The Komodo Dragon.
Would you tell us a little bit about The Komodo Dragon, Doctor?
Happy to. The Komodo Dragon is the world's largest living lizard. It's a ferocious carnivora found on the steep-sloped island of Komodo in the Lesser Sunda chain of the Indonesian archipelago and the nearby islands of Rinja, Padar, and Flores.
Where do they come from?
The Komodo dragon, world's largest living lizard, is found on the island of Komodo in the Lesser Sunda chain of the Indonesian archipelago and the nearby islands of Rinja, Padar, and Flores. Now, we have two in this country that were given to us some years ago by the late former premier of Indonesia, Sukarno, and they reside in the National Zoo in Washington.
I believe I read somewhere where a foreign potentate gave America some Komodo dragons. Is that true?
Yes. The former premier of Indonesia, Sukarno, gifted our country with two Komodo dragons, world's largest living lizards, and they reside at the National Zoo in Washington.
Well, now, if we wanted to take the youngsters to see a Komodo dragon, where would we take the youngsters to see a Komodo dragon?
If you were in the vicinity of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C., you would take the kiddos to the National Zoo, and there you'd see two live Komodo dragons, the world's largest living lizards.
Yeah, Bob, earlier in our interview, said that, you know, he had heard about Komodo dragons and looked them up and got six pieces of information and was off and running. Who would even think to look up something about a Komodo dragon?
Well, the format for that routine actually came about when somebody in San Francisco sent Bob a tape of a legitimate interview about the whooping crane.
Ah.
And it was not a comedy routine at all, but it was hilarious because the interviewer just was inattentive and kept asking the very question that the guest had just answered. So all Bob had to do is pick exotic topics and then look up, you know, various facts about it. They did one about the II lemur that lives in Madagascar. They did that on a show. They did one about one of our old-time presidents. I can't remember who was the president they called Old Kinderhook.
Somebody will let us know. Somebody in the audience. Who was it? 800-486-8655. Yeah. Call us.
And anyway, all you needed was about four or five facts. I mean, all that he was saying about President Sukarno and what zoo he resided in, there were no jokes there. Absolutely just straight pieces of information.
Yeah. Listen. Remember to listen. One of the things you got to do if you're going to be on the radio. It was Martin Van Buren.
Yeah, Martin Van, that's it. Yeah, Martin Van. They did that version on the Dick Cavett Show.
We welcome phone calls. If you'd like to join our conversation, please do, or maybe you're just listening. But I know there are people who are Bob and Ray fans and have questions about their comedy and how they got to know each other and how they just took off their television career, Broadway, Saturday Night Live, etc. David Pollack is our guest. His book is Bob and Ray, Keener Than Most Persons. Here's how you reach us. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest right now is the author of Bob and Ray, Keener Than Most Persons. David Pollack is our guest. And David is an accomplished writer. He has written for The Steve Allen Show, Don Rickles, Carol Burnett, All in the Family, MASH, Cheers, Frasier, wrote nightclub material for Jack Benny, and has won many prestigious awards for his writing. Let's go to Laurel in Duluth, our first caller for you. Hi, Laurel.
Hi.
Hi.
I was wondering if you or your guest had ever heard, it's an audio tape of Bob Elliott reading Robert Benchley.
I have not. I'm sure you probably have. David?
Yes. It was actually put out on an album by, I believe, Camden Records, back maybe in the 80s.
Yes, and, I have a copy, and there is one in there that is absolutely hilarious, and that is an old-fashioned Christmas.
Ah, yeah. it's just like a book on tape. It's Bob reading some of the classic Robert Benchley routines.
Now, they did so much material. I know that there are people who just sort of collected this. There never seemed to be an organized method of collecting all of their comedy. Has there been?
No. No, you've hit upon a real phenomenon. When these shows were on, this was before cassettes, before CDs and all of that. So a lot of fans, including myself, and I discovered them when I was in the eighth grade. This is back in the early 50s when they were on NBC. And this stuff was so funny. And as I followed them along, and they went to various networks. And one time they were on Mutual, then they went to CBS. There was the sense that this stuff is just disappearing into vapor.
Yes,
radio shows weren't repeated in those days, and the only way you could record them was on quarter-inch tape, and on reel-to-reel machines, and. My parents had given me one for Christmas, and it was an old Columbia tape recorder, that they made home models in those days. And so I just started recording those, not really knowing why, but I just to preserve them. And then when they went to, I started this when they were on Mutual, then when they went to CBS, and eventually they were on Monitor. And then So decades go by, and I find out that a lot of people were doing this. And people like Jeffrey Lyons, the NBC critic, Keith Olbermann.
Yes.
Charles Champlin, the drama critic for the Los Angeles Times. It was just this sort of phenomenon. And just recently, when the movie critic Roger Ebert passed away, I read Jeff Greenfield's lovely memorial that he wrote to him, and Jeff said that Roger and I met when Roger was the humor editor of the University of Illinois magazine, and Jeff had the same job at the University of Wisconsin, and they were both Bob and Ray fanatics. We worshipped at the altar of Bob and Ray, Jeff wrote. And every time they met, they would always end their conversation with, "Right, if you get work and hang by your thumb."
Yes, yes.
So all this was going on. It's amazing how many people were taping those shows, and that's why there's sort of a, you know, all collections of it are sort of ragtag, and a lot of people, they record them just by putting a microphone up to a radio speaker. The quality is very uneven on a lot of it.
Right. Thanks so much for the call, Laurel. John on Facebook says, and I think there's a lot of truth in this because generations are discovering them, Bob and Ray are a great example of how a cultural phenomenon can bring people together, especially families. My dad was the first to notice them, and he shared his enjoyment with the rest of the family. There's a lot of that going on, don't you think?
Yeah, and the interesting thing is that as I mentioned, they started, everything they did was mimicking radio. It was broadcasting about broadcasting, and they were spoofing these radio shows. One of them being a show that was on for 18 years called Mr. Keene, Tracer of Lost Persons. That show went off in 1955, and their version was called Mr. Trace, Keener Than Most Persons. That's the play on that for the title of the book.
I love the title. Yeah.
But as the generations evolved, you know, with the turnover of generations, nobody remembered that. Nobody remembered that original Mr. Keene, Tracer of Lost Persons. The bits were just funny in and of themselves, and succeeding generations could enjoy the shows, not even realizing it was spoofing something that had been off for 35 or 40 years.
Ricky in Manitowoc, hi.
Hi. I wanted to congratulate your guest on this effort because it's so delightful to experience a different kind of humor. Today's stuff is often, well, it's sometimes blue, but it's often rhyming or even one-liners. And the delightful part of their humor was their timing. There was time for the audience to fill in and to discover and to share. And I just wanted to thank your guest.
Oh, well, thank you. Yeah, you make a good point. There was no studio audience present to sort of signal, you know, what was funny. So you had to sort of pay attention. And a lot of the fun was just in the relationship between the two of them, you know, the way they played off of each other. You sort of wanted to learn their secret handshake.
Yes. I wonder if they had one. Probably not. I wish they did. Thanks, Ricky, for the call. Robert in West Salem. Hi, Robert.
Good morning.
Hi.
I was a college freshman and sophomore in 1951. And I worked in a canning factory in Janesville where radio contact was Chicago. And every day was a treat to listen to Bob and Ray. I have not been able to talk to many people about my appreciation for them. They were not carried throughout the state of Wisconsin that I'm aware of. But they certainly were a treat.
Yeah, well, in 1951, you were probably hearing them on
That's when they started on NBC, and they had a 15-minute show at 5:45 in the afternoon, and then it was moved to 11:30 in the morning. So that's probably what you were hearing.
When were they on NPR, David?
I think that started in 1981. Those half-hour Bob and Ray public radio shows.
Mm-hmm. The you write also, it wasn't all roses. When Bob was on dialysis, I couldn't believe what he was going through, and dialysis had to be scheduled. Their appearances, yeah, as far away as L.A., they were doing big shows, yeah, in Hawaii, and he was on a dialysis machine several days of the week.
Yeah, you mean Ray. It was Ray.
I'm sorry, Ray. Yeah. Yeah, I meant Ray.
Yeah, it was incredible. It was just it was amazing that he had the stamina to do that. Because,
yes.
Just for the benefit of the listeners, it's all detailed in the book, but kidney disease had run through their family. Ray's mother had died of it, and he lost a sister from it, and another brother, Phil Goulding, who had been a big influence on him. And it involves, as you said, 5 hours of dialysis every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. And so their work was pretty much confined to Tuesdays and Thursdays. And this all started when Ray was just 56 years old. So he was on dialysis for 12 years.
Oh, my goodness.
And by those years, much of the business had sort of migrated to Los Angeles and the West Coast. So all by then the Tonight Show had moved to Los Angeles. That moved in 1972. So it involved flights to the West Coast all the time. And they had also started this advertising business where they were doing regional commercials for various companies, which involved the campaigns in various cities and meetings and so forth. I mean, it was incredible. They had to arrange for dialysis in those cities. Hmm. And it was all done through Ray's wife, Liz, and coordinated with hospitals in those various locations.
Robert, thank you so much for your memories. Virginia in Milwaukee, hi.
Hi, good morning to you both.
Morning.
I'm glad that I got on this morning. Excuse me. I just wanted to say that when I heard you talking about Bob and Ray, see, I was not a fan of these guys, but I heard little snippets of them when I would go to visit my brother. Now, this was in the early 70s here in Milwaukee, and my brother would have them on the radio, and he had his head so close to the radio that we used to kind of kid him and say, well, why don't you put that radio on your head?
I can just imagine people gathering close to their radio to listen. David?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Thanks, Virginia, very much for the call. Well, David, I'm so delighted that you wrote a book and you're keeping them alive and introducing many more people to Bob and Ray. They are so worth hearing, and the book is fascinating.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you. The book is Bob and Ray, Keener Than Most Persons, and it's written by David Pollack. And David has been a writer for The Steve Allen Show, Carol Burnett, Cheers, Frasier, MASH, some of the great pieces of comedy really of all time, and wrote nightclub material for Jack Benny. He's won a Peabody, a Writers Guild, and 2 Humanitas Awards. And our deepest thanks to Bob Elliott, who is 90 years old now, and we were delighted to have a chance to speak with him last week. Well, this was fun, everybody. Thanks, many, many thanks to Rhonda Fanning for putting this all together and putting the comedy pieces, and we'll go out with a Bob and Ray piece in just a moment. Thanks for your calls. I will not be with you on Memorial Day. Just a reminder that we are running the Mike Simonson special documentary from 9 until 11, the Richard Bong story. Please listen to that. Well worth hearing. And my little boy is turning 21 next week. I can't believe that. So we're off to some comedy clubs, actually. I'll be with you again later next week. Thank you. Have a good Memorial Day weekend. Before the news, a little more Bob and Ray.
I think we have just time to say hello to 2 old friends of ours. We almost forgot. the non-identical twin band leaders, the Claude and Clyde, the McBeebe twins. How are you, men?
Oh, just great, Bob and Ray. Things are going along just fine
for us. What have you been doing since we saw you last?
Well, we have an ice cream truck out here in the suburbs. And we have our specials, cherry jubilee, maple walnut, butter crunch. Hey, but you know what? You can have all the specials you want, but you still sell more vanilla ice cream than anything else. Put your money on vanilla, Bob and Ray.
That's the ice cream people want.
Vanilla ice cream. Yeah.
Well, thank you for talking with us. Good luck to both of you.
Well, thanks. It's always a pleasure to be here with you, Bob. Really, we've enjoyed it very much.